You know what would be awesome is if we had a podcasting sidekick that could only say like four words and in different combinations had to review all of the shows.
What would it say?
Like, I mean, well, obviously, like good, bad, Sansa, lackluster. Right? That's all you need to review
I don't think
television.
I can teach a dog how to do that.
Is this some sort of like I am good like comparison? Is this what we're going for?
Well, I mean, I think that even having I'm being one of the critical words this being would do, which violates some sort of efficiency for critic Groot,
It's like
which
if
we're
a
making up right now.
yeah,
Oh,
like we would have like a
guys.
talking weirwood tree.
I'm real scared of the possibilities for critic Groot.
Well, the good thing is you could pre-write almost all of his reviews, right? Yeah, sure.
Maybe. But then there's like the question mark that I am Groot.
Yeah, or it's like, what does critic Groot think of the upcoming seasons of Game of Thrones? Lackluster, Sansa good.
Yeah, but how do you get Sassy Groot? Because we know that Sassy Groot exists.
So it says something and then it snaps three times, and you just have to picture it.
I am Groot.
All right, first you flick this switch, then this switch. That activates it. Then you push this button, which will give you 5 minutes to get out of there. Now, whatever you do, don't push this button, because that will set off the bomb immediately and we'll all be dead. Now, repeat back what I just said.
I am Groot. I am Groot.
That's right.
I am Groot.
No! Now that's the button that will kill everyone! Try again.
I am Groot. I am Groot. I am Groot.
No! That's exactly what you just said! How is that even possible? Which button is the button you're supposed to push? Point to it. No!
Hey, you're making him nervous!
Shut up and give me some tape! Does anybody have any tape out there? I want to put some tape over the death button.
Hello and welcome to Storm of Spoilers Off Season Tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I had to put a track on Awesome Mix Volume 3, I would go back to the Stooges and pick up Shake Appeal off of Raw Power.
Wow, I'm Joanna Robinson, and if I had to pick a song to put on the Awesome Mix Volume 3, I would pick Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard by Paul Simon.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I had to put a song on Awesome Mix Volume 3, it would be Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. That would be the music that I would use as I'm mowing fools down.
It's so interesting because it's hard for me to pick another one, like something like Another One Bites the Dust, or even in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, ELO's Mr. Blue Sky. Like, I identify ELO's Mr. Blue Sky so strongly with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Or is that just me? That's where I first heard the song, was in the trailer for Eternal Sunshine. I was like, what is this grooving song? And then I discovered ELO as a result of it. And then I discovered the movie Xanadu as a result of that. So it was a whole journey I went on that was all pegged to the song.
Yeah,
this guy.
I hit all those signposts just in a completely different order from you.
Yeah, I don't associate Another One Bites the Dust with anything other than being awesome.
Do 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 do. No, 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 no. Oh God! Now this is just gonna. This is so distracting.
Yep.
You, of course, listening to Storm of Spoilers as we rush towards our usual Game of Thrones programming later this year. We're in crazy off-season season tour mode and have the blessing of talking about Guardians of the Galaxy this week because it's super enjoyable. But first, Joanna, do we have any new reviews this week?
We do. Speaking of enjoyable, we have a couple nice five-star reviews that I'm going to read right now. The first one is from... Sorry, I can't... Oh, here it is. It's from Kelly Easy, Mother of Mutts.
Oh, that's great.
Love the pod like I love pod. Five stars. My husband, who claims to love Game of Thrones, does not love my need to dissect every scene down to the shot, compare and contrast with books, search the internet for fan theories, and compulsively read a wiki of Ice and Fire. Enter this podcast, which is saving my marriage. Update: the off-season tour is even better. I am now unable to consume media without getting Joanna, Dave, and Neil's perspectives on it. And I'll read one more. This one comes from Sean Safari. 5 stars. Love it. This is a short one. It just says, Dave and Neil are rad, but I mainly listen for Joanna's uhs and ums. So those are our reviews this
week. I like that guy.
Thank you.
Person, lady, I don't know, whatever they are.
That person. Yeah, that person is plugged in fully to the Star Wars spoilers culture. Right.
Yep.
So guys, as you know, you can leave us 5-star reviews over at iTunes. It helps us out. We read them. We read all of them. We pay attention to the ones that have 5 stars.
Sometimes we tweet about them.
What they say.
It's fine.
Oh, we most definitely tweet about them. Only when they get 5 stars do we tweet about them, though. Before that, we get to do what we want. Yeah. Now, Neil, we've been leaving this out since we're getting so close to Game of Thrones time, but we're going to go to Neil for, we already talked about this already, because there's been Game of Thrones news.
Yeah.
Neil, it's time for Neil's mini show. What's up this week?
That intro was a little redundant. Like, there were too many words in that sentence. Like, more
we
things
already
than
talked
we really
about this already.
It's
before.
Like, it's like more things than we actually needed, you know, which
it
has
actually,
nothing to do
though,
with what Neil is about to say next.
What the kids say really is kinda extra. It's extra already.
We sort of, it does sort of sum up this segment because it's more than we need. Everything's more. Anyway, we got an emergency raven this week as we, even though we're headed back to the Citadel of Crazy Town. That's right. We can role play this out a little bit. I'm getting back into form. But we got an emergency raven about Game of Thrones spinoffs. Actually, we got numerous ones, which is people tweeting at us, emailing, and, sending smoke signals about, hey, you guys should talk about these Game of Thrones spinoffs. So this all started from a report from IGN from our friend Terry Schwartz, who we know.
Who helped us escape the escape room.
Yes.
South by Southwest. By sort being of. Our she was our surprise at the end. Really, right. I think she made that escape room experience for us. So.
It really, yes. After we defeated the escape room, she was there awaiting us with, you know, fun, a smile. She had a smile. Anyway, she did some hard work on this and found out that Game of Thrones, or I'm sorry, HBO, the home box office network, is working on not one, not two, not three, but 4 potential Game of Thrones spinoffs. And so far, we don't know much about them. But here's what we do know, and then I want to get you guys' take. We know that George R.R. Martin is working individually with 2 of the writers that they've hired. And so he's involved with at least 2. And we know that the writers that they have engaged to begin working on this include Max Borenstein, who wrote Kong Skull Island, Jane Goldman, who wrote Kingsman, The Golden Circle, and Kick-Ass, and who is Kick-Ass, Brian Helgeland, who wrote Legend and other famous things, and Carly Rae, who has been on Mad Men, The Leftovers. So the one takeaway that I got, Goldman and Rae have already begun working with George R. R. Martin, according to this report. So,
yeah, can't have the ladies working on their own. Sorry.
Well, no, I actually think of it more of like a chivalrous thing, like ladies first to get to George, because eventually they're all going to have to talk to George, right?
No, what the news is that Brian and Max are working on their own, whereas the other concepts are Jane and George and Carly and George.
I tried to give HBO the benefit of the doubt here.
I don't think it's sexism. I think it's coincidence. It just doesn't look great, but it's fine.
Anyway, so there's a couple big things that stand out. One, this is a lot of talented writers that are now attached to this. 2, what we knew already was no Weiss and Benioff. Also interesting is no Brian Cogman and no Dave White.
Dave Hill?
Hill. Mm-hmm. That guy.
Yeah, just burned everybody out.
That's so really, the 4 people who are in the main writer's room now on Thrones are not there, which might not be such a bad thing. But also, it's nice to see a slightly more diverse lineup of writers taking on Thrones, which is sort of where Game of Thrones started, because they had people like Michelle McLaren and What's her, Alan Taylor's wife? Wasn't she also in the writer's room for season one?
Jane Espenson was.
And Jane Espenson. Mm-hmm. Yep. So they had a more diverse writer's room to start with, and it's sort of whittled down over the seasons to, you know, four dudes.
I don't think McLaren was ever in the writer. You just mean she directed some episodes.
Well, no, right? she was a executive producer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that. I learned a thing. Anyway. I think the interesting question is, like, we actually don't know how many shows HBO will greenlight. Like, it's entirely possible.
We know how many they want a greenlight.
Yeah, they want it all four, I think is what they want. I think they want Thrones year-round. I think they want a winter, summer, spring, fall Thrones show and just always be Thronesing.
Right. They want it to be an exponential thing where they, like, make four, and those four each get four of their own spinoffs, and then there's 16. And it's
call that the James Wan horror model.
But or maybe they just want one, and they're sort of like, you know, just seeing who has the best pitch. We don't quite know. I mean, I would guess that they want all four, but maybe they just want one, or maybe they're just planning for one, and they're going to see which pitch is best. Each of the four teams is covering a different writing a pitch on a different period of time, and I would bet that one of the George R. R. Martin's teams is doing the Duncan Egg stories, because that's what George has said for years is what he thinks the spinoff series should be. And of course there's other, you know, ideas that people have had that might make a good spinoff, like Robert's Rebellion or the Targaryen Clash of Dance of Dragons and all sorts of stuff. We don't know for sure what they're covering. And what I'm really curious about actually is whether or not HBO actually wants a show co-written, co-produced by George R. R. Martin, or whether it would prefer not to. Because I actually don't know what it's been like for... I know what they've said, but I don't know what it's actually been like for them to work with George on previous seasons. We know George is no longer working on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't know if HBO has the rights, so they can go forward really without George. So I don't know if for simplicity's sake they want to do it without George, or for authenticity's sake they want to do it with George. You know?
Yeah, I guess the other big question, that's all very interesting because there is like that behind the scenes political dynamic. But my question is, do you think it's possible that that any of these, more particularly the ones that George is already consulting on, are post A Song of Ice and Fire, like post quote. This is a sequel. It's called a sequel. But do you think any that's stupid. Don't be stupid. It's a sequel. Because I guess we assume that all of it is prequel stuff, or like side stories, or like, you know, secretly in my heart of hearts, it's like the Queen Nymeria brings her people to Westeros story, which is super fascinating and would be awesome. And, you know, they probably won't do that because they don't like me. But
here's why I hope not, Neil.
Yes,
because
go.
That leaves for fuckery where they try to seed a spinoff in next season of Game of Thrones. And I don't want any of that fuckery.
Well, so yeah, that's the thing. We don't know the ending. We don't know how Game of Thrones ends. So we don't know if there's potential for more after that. Like, we just know that Weiss and Benioff know what George has told them is the end of this story. But, like, what if somebody ends up on the throne and they're like, well, maybe we should see what happens to Jon Snow when he's king of everything that is now, like, one hold because the White Walkers destroyed everything else or
whatever. Oh, I'm sorry. You mispronounced when Daenerys Targaryen is queen of everything. I misheard you.
She's queen of everything. They're married now in this. Okay. We know who really runs the show, okay? John's just a figurehead. He's always has been. In fact, he's just an empty vessel at this point.
And so, what a fine figure of hair he is.
Yeah, so I guess that is what I think could be potentially very fascinating is any of this going to be an extension of the story that we're watching finish in the next 2 years?
Yeah, according to Terry, you know, the language she uses, each of the writers is exploring various time periods set in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire universe. So you're exactly right. Some of those time periods could be in the future. We don't know.
future. Yeah. Like when they start building roads and bridges
and elevators. Wait, they already have an elevator.
What if it was like Westeros 2025? And it's like future version of Westeros with like buildings and shit. Actually, fascinating thought experiment. What happens to Westeros 2,000 years in the future?
Harrison Ford wears a gray t-shirt and lives out in the desert.
What if it's like Beastmaster 2, where Beastmaster goes to LA? What if it's Davos goes to 1980s LA?
Oh my God, yes. Or like, yeah, like Highlander shows up. Because yeah, we know that time travel's a thing, theoretically.
Sure. But like, yeah, they go through into another dimension and it's Los Angeles.
Can Bran throw someone into the future? That's what we want to know.
Well, as long as he doesn't throw them into Westeros world or whatever the fuck you guys were talking about earlier this year, I'm fine. Max Borenstein's stupid idea can't be the Westworld.
I mean,
Westeros crossover.
Can
no?
Can we just say that I'm sure somewhere in HBO's building there's a whiteboard where it's like someone wrote across the top of it, how do we connect Westworld and Westeros? And I mean, then there's just like a yarn wall underneath it.
They need to hire Ridley Scott, who has connected aliens and robots slowly over like a 2.5 decades to crack that egg.
That's a weird thing to say because robots and aliens coexist in the original Alien. So,
well, no, let's okay, not spoil next week's too
for,
much.
For
but
Alien Covenant. No, let's not spoil it at all. Here's my question. Here's my thought experiment before I think we should probably move on, which is, of the four writers that are not George R. R. Martin, which one would you most want to see execute a Game of Thrones? Oh, we should say that Weiss and Benioff are going to executive produce no matter what.
They're getting goes their names and they collecting yeah those checks.
Yep.
I'm going to roll the Carly Rae series.
Okay. She wrote some great episodes of Mad Men. So.
Yes. It's specifically the Mad Men thing and working, I think, in that room would teach her a lot about running a Game of Thrones room, from what I remember of Mad Men coverage.
That's an excellent pick from a pragmatic standpoint. Like, Carly Rae has all kinds of TV experience and is not crazy. Jane Goldman is crazy, and I love her. She did, you know, Kingsman, X-Men First Class, Kick-Ass, the very underrated Stardust. Mm-hmm. I want to see whatever Jane Goldman wants to do. I've had this policy for movies. I would like to see her do just, and then she gets on press tours and she's got her awesome super red hair and she's just the most fabulous human being.
It's
so
the most red hair I've ever seen.
And yes, and she's British and brash, and I think that she will make whatever. It could be a hot mess, but it'll be super fun.
I also vote Jane Goldman because of her collaboration with Matthew Vaughn. I like all of those movies. She's married to Jonathan Ross, who is a British figure whom I love, and she produces one of my favorite shows of all time, which is this British panel show called Big Fat Quiz of the Year, which is an amazing sort of annual trivia competition between British comedians, which is just endlessly delightful and on YouTube if you've never watched it. Anyway, yes. So that's two votes for Jane Goldman, one vote for Carly Rae, which means actually three votes for George, and nothing for you, Brian or Max. Bye.
Nothing for you, but you all get green lights you've been handed a golden egg.
I do also think that is, we're about to reach a sort of sad moment where we realize that George isn't going to finish these books. And George is also reaching that moment, I'm sure, somewhere deep in his heart. So I think that is sort of an interesting way for George to sort of flesh out the story. This is what George likes to do. He likes to world build.
I'm not ready to give up on George yet. I believe he has delivered the manuscript for Winds of Winter. So he has the rest of his life, however long that is, to write The Dream of Spring, and then he's done.
And I believe it's going to be one chapter, and it's just going to be the White Walkers kill everyone, the end.
Jesus.
You guys are all assholes. The White Walkers win, the end. Love, George.
XOXO Gossip Girl. But yeah, he, I know, there was some piece circulating, I forget who wrote it, this week, right? That was like, George R. R. Martin shouldn't finish the books or something like that. I'm like, fuck you. He should. He should finish the books. Do it, George.
Yeah, I'm not saying he shouldn't. Do it at your own pace. I'm just saying he's not going to. So.
Well, not with that attitude, Neil Miller.
I know. I know. All right, and with that, I think it's time for a break. But before we go to a break, we need to say something about breaks.
Yes,
we had some things we wanted to say.
Announce when we go to breaks now. Because we've been had a sudden change in our ad structure, and we've been hearing your complaints. We're going to try to lean into it, but please know that our ad structure is retroactive, meaning past episodes need to have breaks in certain time periods. I've tried to go back and place those for you. Some of them are going to be pretty rough. Them's just the breaks, literally.
The ad breaks.
The ad breaks, like this one right now. So guys, the Marvel Universe is not just the Marvel Cinematic Universe because it's been expanding into television. The last time we talked about it, we were talking about Iron Fist, and I had to ban somebody from the fightinginthewarroom.com comments section this week because that's how long the argument about whether or not we gave Iron Fist the fair shift.
They were mad at us?
Oh yeah, apparently.
I thought we went easy on Iron Fist. It could have been worse.
Well, wanting Danny Rand to be an Asian American actor apparently is just as racist as whitewash casting. And the way we use the term Asian was just as bad as using the term Oriental, according to this person that's now banned from the website for continuing to say that.
That's not true.
So that's the state of the Marvel universe when we last.
Asia's a continent.
I tried to make that argument.
The Orient is not a real. That's racist.
Also,
Oriental is for rugs and ramen flavors.
Excellent.
And I'd be okay if the ramen flavor changed it from Oriental, like to it could just call itself blue. But the blue top ramen is the best top ramen, and that's the only time that I will countenance the word Oriental.
Wow. Okay. I just learned a lot all in that like one sentence.
That I have top ramen feelings.
That you have strong top ramen feelings, that there are multiple flavors of top ramen.
What? You didn't know that?
I mean, I guess. I don't know. I mean, are the different colors in this grocery store? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. No, the blue one is definitely called Oriental, but it is kind of weird.
It's weird, but it's the best one. It's like, is the problem. I'd quit it, except the other ones are like chicken and beef. And I don't know, like, they obviously don't know what to call it. They should call it MSG. That's probably what it is. Just call it MSG. I'll still buy it. You could take the Red Oriental out the
back. This one has the bad stuff.
This one has the most sodium. Please
or
enjoy
just
it.
Original? I feel like original
Ooh,
would be fine.
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't even have to reprint all of the words.
It's the flavor. Fine.
So this is the state of the Marvel Universe. So uninteresting, we had to talk about Top Ramen first. But there is bright stars on the horizon, both cinematically and on television. We wanted to stop by and give some updates, I think, to Neil. I think Neil's the one in need of the Marvel Universe updates.
Well, yeah, because I learned as we were prepping for this that I apparently forgot. I have amnesia. I have Marvelnesia. I don't remember what the hell shows are coming out.
Well, today we got news that the X-Men television series The Gifted, which is going to be a Marvel Studios Fox co-production, is going to actually come to series. We're going to get a trailer for it, which will be out by the time you guys hear this. We've seen the teaser for the trailer, and it looks not bad for Marvel television. At least I didn't think so.
It doesn't look low budge the way that the ABC shows always do. And hey, Amy Acker. I don't know.
It kind of looks like a CW Marvel show, which is a compliment in this regard, because I think I generally think of CW as like halfway in between FX and ABC. Yeah. So, like, they at least try stylish stuff, but maybe it's a little cheaper. So it might be that the Goldilocks middle between Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Legion, if that's what you're looking for.
Just right.
Yeah.
Well, and, like, Legion was a daring experiment, and I think structurally it showed that off. The Gifted is, I think, like the kind of series that the X-Men characters were made to do. Like, these are where you want your B-level X-Men characters are on the run from a, you know, crazy governmental-like entity, which is what it appears like the Gifted is going to be. Like, that's...
And we heard that there are, what, aren't there, like, sentinels involved in this?
Ooh.
Yes.
And I think sentinels are fun.
I think that the thing, and Stephen Moyer, a.k.a. Vampa Bill from True Blood, is also in it.
Sook it.
I think, sook it, don't. but I think one of the things that we're worried about is, what is it, Dave? Would it be Bryan Singer's involvement in this show?
Oh, sure.
Well, it's a Bryan Singer, Jeff Loeb produced show, so I'm already just like, but that being said, the executive producers set a tone and then get to walk away and let a whole bunch of other people step in. So that's what I'm hoping takes
over. It's actually being run by Matt Nix, who created Burn Notice. So,
oh, I like that guy.
Yeah.
Burn Notice is underrated. Don't at me.
When you're a spy.
When you're a mutant, everyone wants to capture you.
When you're a mutant, you can take a cell phone and make it into a... Anyway, I hope they eat a lot of yogurt on Gifted. That's all I have to say.
I just like that there's... I just want to say that an appreciation for Burn Notice warms my heart. So, because I actually like that show. Seriously, don't at me.
Burn Notice aired before Peak TV when I could waste my time sometimes on USA shows that were just fine. Burn Notice is just a fine show. I could watch it and not feel bad about it. But now I can't enjoy it.
The sad story of Rizzoli and Isles is that it came on after Peak TV started.
But it still ran. It still ran for longer than, you know, Sweet Vicious.
Well, yeah, because USA is on in like bars during the day. So...
Now everybody just watches, what is it, Suits? Is Suits still going?
Suits is definitely still going.
What's the one where they were doctors for the rich kids?
I was about to say Pacific Med, but it's not that. It's like some pun.
Yeah, it's like the OC. I don't know. Dr. OC. No, now I'm thinking of Dr. Oz. No, but it was the guy from Rescue Me.
Yeah.
The doctor. Anyway, what... What the hell were we even talking about here?
Well, we were talking about The Gifted. I don't know too much about the characters that are going to appear on this. I've heard rumors that Blink is actually going to be in it. She's the teleporting one.
Royal Pains. And it had that prescription between the R and the P. Anyway.
Royal Pains. Is his name Royal or Pain? No. No one's named Royal or Pain. I think the pun here is that since they're treating the rich in the Hamptons, those rich people are a real royal pain in the ass.
Right.
Know?
They're treating the pain of the royals, but they're right. Also painful people to do.
Royal pain.
See, right. I get it.
Okay. Sorry, Dave.
None of this is Marvel related.
No, it is not. But that's okay. It gave me some time to Google something that doesn't necessarily have an answer yet, which is when we could see more of Gifted. If it's picked up, I'm assuming that means fall season.
This said fall in the teaser.
Good. This said fall in the teaser. No actual date yet. September-ish Gifted sounds about right to me.
My question is, like, when has Fox... Well, I guess other than the X-Files. Fox, I think, has had slightly trouble... record pulling off a genre serialized show, right?
That doesn't have Jack Bauer in it. Yes,
I'm talking about like
genre, sci-fi, superhero.
Yeah, sci-fi. Yeah. So like, I'm thinking like Minority Report, Sleepy Hollow tanked after the first season. You know, I just don't have a lot of faith in Fox as a brand.
Wait,
in pulling this off.
Fringe.
Yeah, Fringe. You're right.
Fringe was good. I like that show.
Yeah, and
it was also on Fox,
season,
I think.
But it was crazy.
No, you're right. I think if there's any, I don't know, it'll be fine. Whatever.
It'll depend a lot with they put it up against, and I think there's certain things that I don't think genre television can even go up against in prime time, and still like cut a piece out for itself, but. Maybe The Runaways will prove
they should pair it.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. wrong.
They should pair it with the X-Files. That's what they should do. They should give us
that would be great.
A sci-fi block, which is what, you know, I think they used to do, so.
Well, and then that would also mean getting X-Files faster, which I'd be all for.
Because it gives Chris Carter less time to like get bogged down in mythology. Just give us those one-offs. That's all we want.
They should
like
put
an old version of TV where you just have to let the showrunner do his crazy thing.
They should put all the sci-fi shows on.
Do not have to let Chris Carter do his crazy. His crazy thing was terrible in the X-Files reboot.
Yeah, until he sells it off, you gotta put up with his crazy ideas. This is what I learned living through George Lucas. You just gotta let him poop himself out.
They should put them all on Friday and call it TXIF. Thank Xenu, it's Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a sci-fi thing.
Or is it?
I don't know.
Is it real? All
right. To be answered on the by the Gifted this September.
Thank Ego, it's Friday. What?
Thank you.
What?
Oh. Hey, we're not even done talking about the other television stuff yet. They're already pushing us in that direction. All right. The other one I want to talk about, The Runaways, is going to be coming to Hulu. It's a Marvel series in 2018. It's going to have 10 episodes. This is fun because this is a property that I wanted to be a Marvel movie way back before the MCU was even like a thing. It is a Brian K. Vaughan created series about a whole bunch of kids who discover their parents are part of a supervillain group called the Pride. They've totally cast this with not just white people. And have begun production on it.
And the comic, we should say, is also not just white people.
Correct. They've accurately cast it,
yes.
And that means diversity casting,
yes.
Which for Marvel television, outside of some Asian faces on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is very welcome, this is by far their most diverse television outing. By far. Unless, I don't know, do we count all the different Pan-Asian versions of the hand as different social.
I mean,
yeah. What country
Luke
in
Cage? I don't know.
What kind of Oriental is Sigourney Weaver?
Hey, all right. So let's just not, and just say The Runaways is a really good comic if you haven't read it. Dave, do you think you're going to see a dinosaur?
I'm going to see a dinosaur.
All right.
This is better have a dinosaur because one of her. One of the powers, I believe, of Molly is just the dinosaur. So
is it a real dinosaur or is it like Vixen in DC Comics where it's like a blue laser show?
It's a dinosaur.
Awesome.
It's a telepathic dinosaur.
I love dinosaurs.
Telepathic dinosaur.
I'm for it.
Telepathic dinosaur. And we should say that Joss Whedon also wrote a run of The Runaways, which is not as good as the Brian K. Vaughan. Yeah, I said it. This is a great comic that I read, I think, just last year because I heard a rumbling that it was... Right. We knew it was coming, so I read the comics so I could be smug and know things about it. There you go.
Yep. It films in Los Angeles under the title Rugrats. Don't get excited. There's not a live-action Rugrats movie.
And
but if you see Rugrats around,
now I'm disappointed.
Look for a raptor.
And it's Josh Schwartz of the OC fame, the OC and Gossip Girl fame. So
correct. And Stephanie Savage is also, I think.
XOXO. Dinosaur.
A dinosaur. Dinosaur. let's see.
I want an episode to be called XOXO Dinosaur.
I mean, that's probably not out of the range considering what Supergirl's second season finale is called Nevertheless, She Persisted. So,
it's real on the nose.
I just alienated some people. Sorry, guys.
All right.
Hey, listen, I'm for it.
Good. Keeping with things you're going to be for, Marvel's also bringing Squirrel Girl to Freeform, which is not broadcast. It's one of those services, services you could get.
I thought it was a channel.
Freeform is the artist formerly known as ABC Family. They rebranded as Freeform.
Oh, shit.
CW Seed is not.
That's the one. That's okay.
That's the one where they stuck what's that show where the guy can't die? Forever? I think it's called Forever.
Oh, they put Forever on CW Seed?
Yeah, but I think it's actually
like
old episodes.
Yeah,
I think
it was
CW
on ABC.
Seed.
It was on ABC.
CW Seed is like the Netflix of like old CW shows. So
ABC is now gonna like fuck with my whole paradigm. all right. So
Freeform,
formerly ABC Family, will be 10 episodes of Squirrel Girl, in 2018. This is the second.
But wait, isn't it called something else though? It's not Squirrel Girl.
It's New Warriors.
Oh, okay.
I believe is the way that it started.
She's
as a Squirrel
just
Girl,
the cool one.
Yeah, she's the cool one of the New Warriors. She wasn't originally part of the New Warriors team, so there will be other heroes, but the Squirrel Girl is sort of like the headline.
I guess it's
in terms of popular characters.
You know, it's a disappointing time to do a Squirrel Girl thing from a rights standpoint, because most of the cool, I've not read a ton of Squirrel Girl, so this is probably not correct. But all the Squirrel Girl stuff I've seen.
I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm going to go ahead anyway.
Guys, right now I'm just tapping into essential podcasts here, which is, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm going to say it anyway. But I feel like Squirrel Girl also interacts with other fun characters like Miles Morales, Spider-Man, which that's never going to happen. I mean, not for this at least. But like,
well, we're going to have to see where all of these new series take place and how much crossing over is going to happen. So they all have Marvel as a name, but thus far what we've seen across networks and whatnot is all that means is they get to mention the incident or the event from the first Avengers film
the
5 years ago.
The big green guy.
Yep. Well, they can't even really they don't even really say actual character names. So Freeform has Squirrel Girl and Cloak and Dagger. Those are on the same network, so it's possible those two things can cross over, which is weird because Cloak and Dagger actually in the comics crosses over with the Runaways pretty early on. But that's on Hulu and thus far by itself in terms of Marvel properties.
It's so part of the Marvel Huluverse.
I'd be okay with them not like feeling hamstrung by rights. If Squirrel Girl can still like steal Tony Stark's Iron Man suit, but never actually like mention, like just has it.
But imagine,
even has to say like Tony Stark. Or
imagine if it was like a bad version, where it's like she stole armor from Todd Snark.
I don't know if they're going to do off-brand, but yeah.
That would be kind of a fun, very Squirrel Girly thing, too.
I am a little bummed about this new Warriors thing, because the thing that I love so much about the Squirrel Girl comic, which I think is empirically the best comic out there right now. It's written by Ryan North, who did the Great Dinosaur comics, and he's on the show. But the interaction of Squirrel Girl with her college roommate Doreen Green, and then there's Koi Boy and Chipmunk Hunk, like all these like fun off-brand heroes that she hangs out with, and I would much rather see that, like a college show like Felicity but with Squirrel Girl, rather than these new Warriors. I'm still happy that we're getting a Squirrel Girl show, even though it's not called Squirrel Girl, but I would love them to be as faithful to comics as the current comics as possible, which is not what they're going to do, and that's okay too.
Yeah, well, I guess we don't really know. All we know in terms of what they've signaled is that they are saying this is their first live-action scripted comedy, so it's going to have a little bit more wiggle room in terms of, I don't know, what Marvel thinks is the difference between Marvel comedy and not Marvel comedy, but I think it has the possibility to do something really cool like what you're talking about. It's just whether or not it's going to actually pop up on Freeform, or whether it's going to be kind of family friendly to the point of saccharine sweetness, which is what I fear.
Well, we should say that showrunner is he's a showrunner, Kevin Beagle, who did Cougar Town, Scrubs, and that show about three brothers who are in the army that I can't remember. Enlisted.
Yeah.
Not Unlisted, Doana. And those are all sweet shows. They are, actually, but not without their sharp edges. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's sweet, but not overly saccharine as some ABC Family stuff can be. And we should remember that ABC Family did, not Gossip Girl, but the one that's like Gossip Girl's Pretty Little Liars. There I go.
Right.
It's not Big Little Lies. Pretty Little Liars. And that show had a lot of edgy shit in it. So, you know, and so does some of their other currently airing stuff. So I think ABC Family kind of gets a bad rap because it does like air all the Harry Potter movies or whatever. But it also, in some of its dramas, has some edgy content in there. So.
Yeah. It got such a bad rap, I didn't even notice it was called Freeform. So I'm glad we're going to find some more Marvel characters there. And then finally, rounding out our future on, I guess, Marvel-related television, Defenders wrapped up. We've seen a trailer. Jessica Jones Season 2 currently shooting. The Punisher about 3 or 4 weeks out from finishing production, from what I understand. All coming down the pike. Guys, you saw the Defenders preview. It surprisingly also feels like Iron Fist is not liked by his teammates, which is what we were hoping was going to happen.
That's the best. That guy sucks.
The kid with the glowing fist, says Stick, who is back for some reason.
We talked about this last week. We did.
Yeah, I think we did, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Well,
this is literally another, we talked about this before. This is like when we tried to talk about Legion last week, we had already talked about it.
Well, I mean, I believe all of our excellent points from last week stand then.
Yes.
Stuff I learned about the Defenders since then, they've been trying to talk about the villain like it's going to be a surprise. I read an interview with the costume designer that said Sigourney Weaver works for something that has been behind each of the shows, but she didn't say the Hand, and she said she couldn't say. Is there a chance we are not seeing the Hand?
No. No. silly Dave.
All right.
No, well, I mean,
good to know.
I mean, you agree with that, right, Dave? You're not like thinking it's not the Hand.
I mean, at this point, it would surprise me greatly, and I would be very, very pleased if what we've seen of Elektra coming back doesn't involve them being in the costumes, because they deal with the Hand before the series is over. It would please me to no end if Sigourney Weaver wasn't part of the Hand, which is why I keep looking for these little ways to wriggle out.
Here's the question, though.
Yeah.
If not the Hand, then whom?
I don't know. At this point, don't you just want Kingpin to come and be like, I planned it all along, and yes. Be like, oh, shit.
I mean, yes, yeah. I
do. Yeah. I miss you, Vince. Come back to me. Can you imagine Vince and Sigourney together? I don't know why I'm calling him Vince, as if that's something I'm allowed to do. But have you, Neil, remember when, I think it was Jacob from Celestial was telling us about Vincent D'Onofrio's Twitter feed?
Vincent D'Onofrio follows Film School Rejects / One Perfect Shot on Twitter, and is
that's not what Jacob was telling
us. No. His first of all, no. This I'm good. Trust me, this is going somewhere.
Okay.
One, he gives us a hard time all the time. Like, he tells us what we're doing wrong. Like, if we post a negative review of something, he's like, "Lighten up, guys." And I'm just like, Vincent D'Onofrio knows who we are. This is crazy. But also, yes, I've seen his Twitter feed, and it's fascinating.
Crazy balls, in a good way. So I'm trying to find that one. I was something about like being a meatball hunter. I don't. I'm doing it to service. But do yourself a solid and go through Vincent D'Onofrio's Twitter feed. It is delight and a joy. I hope that it's not Kingpin who is behind it all. I hope it was the actor Vincent D'Onofrio who is behind everything that happened in the Marvel Netflix series. All right.
You know, I played Thor once, says Vincent D'Onofrio.
He played a good Thor.
Wait,
he
what?
Did.
Adventures in
Babysitting, bro.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Don't say it like that, like it's not valid.
We're of the age group.
No, I'm just trying to say it like I remember that.
Yeah. No, it goes without saying. Everybody knows exactly the reference I was making. Guys, speaking of, culture from the 80s that suddenly comes back, let's take a break and then delve into Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Guys, I think I have a new favorite Marvel movie, but it's really close. It's in the top three for me. It's called Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And I keep prefacing this when I talk to people and tell people about it, because I feel like me having positive things to say about a Marvel movie is nothing good. This has nothing to do with any of the other Marvel movies outside of Guardians of the Galaxy. They say the word Thanos, but you don't need to know about that. They say Infinity Stone. You don't need to know about that. It's self-contained. And because of that, ends up sort of being a delightful plumbing of characters that we ended up liking and that maybe we didn't spend enough time with in the first movie, and, you know, manages to expand its roster and sort of keep its climax feeling somewhat personal, even though it does have, you know, some universe galaxy-wide stakes. And I think it really manages to be a one of those odd duck Marvel films that has a point of view that isn't let's push the greater MCU plotline forward. Let's go to Neil for his thoughts.
I am with you on a number of those points that you just made, including the self-containedness of it. I actually saw some criticisms of Guardians. I waited until Monday of this week to see it because I had other stuff. So I went and saw it in the afternoon, and one of the things that I find really interesting about Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Volume 2, is that there were a lot of folks who were like, it was like not enough happened, or there wasn't a story. Someone actually, I saw that, like, it doesn't have a story. And I was like, wait a minute. Let's talk about this for a second. It's not that it doesn't have a story. It's that it doesn't have the abundance of story and threading and interconnectivity that some of the other Marvel movies, because it doesn't have to jump through the hoops that Captain America Civil War had to, or that pretty much any Earth-based Marvel movie has to in order to fit into the larger environment or the larger expanded universe. So I think that really works to its credit, because you get this story where it's just sort of about what happens when Peter Quill actually meets his father, and the father turns, you know, he's, it's all this, the team being very skeptical about this, and it's about them solving problems. And so I really liked the simplicity of it. I also really liked the way that they delivered a lot of the action, which was, it wasn't that we have to follow everybody around action stuff. It was just like action things are happening and there's problems to be solved. And all of a sudden you're in this huge action sequence and you didn't really, there was no like setup to it. It just sort of happens. And so every story decision in there felt very organic, felt very natural. It felt like you're watching sort of how life plays out, where, you know, there's not like a moment in your life where you stop and someone tells you a bunch of exposition about that is going to then relate to what's going to about to happen in your life. So it just, your life just happens. So I like that a lot. And I thought these characters, I will spend all the time with them. They are fun. And the one visual thing that struck out to me is the incredible use of color. Like it.
Yeah, this, a friend that I saw it with was like, is this a big fuck you to Zack Snyder? All the color in this movie.
You know what? That is what a lot of folks will draw from that. What I saw in it was, this is the like trauma James Gunn coming out, where like he's like, I'm just going to do some weird stuff. And that's that. And like it's like they put him in charge of this movie. Cool. This is full on James Gunn, which I absolutely love. It doesn't always work for me. Like Slither didn't work for me, but like the just unbridledness of what he does in this movie visually, just it's delightful. And it has the best opening credit sequence in the history of superhero movies. And I'm pro Baby Groot. I found out today that people are anti Baby Groot.
Ugh, those stupid think pieces.
I mean, those people, I have words for them, but I'm not going to say it because I'm a gentleman.
Look, can I?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Your turn.
No, not at all. Okay, so I saw this twice. The first time I saw it was a couple weeks ago when I was down at Marvel Studios, and I saw it in the, like, Disney lot screening room with like almost all film critics and some Marvel employees. And I was sitting next to one of my favorite people in the world, Seth Freilich of Pajiba.com.
Oh, Seth.
Yeah, Seth. And I did not like the movie when I saw it there. And it, you know, there was just, I think there was, I love Seth, but he is very critical, and that's one of the reasons why I love him. And he sort of went into it, and then I sort of followed him in tone of being like, this is not going to be very good. Like, no way that can this be very good. It's too far up its own ass. And that's sort of how I felt. I was like, I felt like they just, it, a lot of the decisions were cheap and leaning into the, you know, like, oh, you like Baby Groot? We're going to give you, we're going to just shove Baby Groot in your face for like a long time, blah, blah. Okay. So that was sort of my attitude about Guardians. And then this last weekend, I always see every single comic book movie with the same group of friends at the Alamo Drafthouse, no matter if I've seen it before at a critic screening. And I saw it with the group of friends in the Alamo Drafthouse full of just like fans. And I loved it. And I don't know if it was the second viewing or just the tone in the room was different. But I really loved it the second time. And a friend of mine really sort of helped convince me about how well Baby Groot was used, because it's not just that, oh, you love Baby Groot, we're going to give you more Baby Groot. That's true. That is what they did. But also the silent way that this group of people protect this small thing together. There are moments in the film where they just hand Groot off. And that's what the intro is. The intro is like, yeah, Baby Groot dancing. Okay, that's fucking cute. But like everyone's sort of checking in on him.
Right.
Really builds this sense of family unit. You know, and Gamora saying goodbye to a crying Groot, or Star-Lord telling him to put a seatbelt on, and like all this sort of stuff. And it's just sort of like, it's like three men and a baby. It's like four heroes and a baby or whatever. You know, like you give them this thing to protect, and then all of a sudden they're not just a ragtag group of squabbling, whatever. They're actually a family. And I know throughout the movie they say they're family.
Not quite as much as the Fast and Furious movie.
Right. But showing it, they use Baby Groot to show that this is a family versus the constant like Vin Dieseling of we're family.
No,
so,
we're family.
Yeah. It's I am Groot instead of we are family, and both said by Vin Diesel. And, it really works. It really works. And so you know, we're spoiling Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Right? Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 out in theaters right now. Go ahead.
So that, you know, that then works into the, you know, other threads of the film, which is about Gamora and Nebula's sister relationship, Star-Lord and Ego's father-son relationship, Star-Lord and Yondu's father-son relationship. And so it's all family. And it's why so many people are having an emotional reaction to this movie. That and Michael Rooker is freaking fantastic in this movie. And, yeah, so I still have some complaints. Like, Sylvester Stallone can't enunciate it at the best of times, so why would you give him a bunch of space jargon to say? I don't know. But
oh my god, that's so true. He can't do space jargon.
He can't. But a lot of
guys know that the colors of Orgood will never fly over his
humor. But they did. But they did.
Angrier than that,
he was
though.
Wrong. can I think that you hit on something that I also really liked, which was the nonverbal ways that they integrate Baby Groot into the story. And I think it all comes to a head during that, the colors of Oregon or whatever scene, with little Cat Stevens playing, where there's this sequence where they just sort of like pass a little Groot around. Yeah. And it just feels like this like natural, like way that you would pass a baby around without even thinking about it, in as like a family that's moving around. And like I found that to be a super emotional part of the moment. It's like, oh my god, Baby Groot.
Exactly. And it's not just like, oh, this is a cute thing. I mean, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Rian Johnson said at Star Wars Celebration that like he said BB-8 is like the Buster Keaton of the Star Wars universe. Like, put right. as much BB-8 in as possible. And like, Baby Groot is like BB-8 plus. You know what I mean? Like, it's a cute thing that you always want to be looking at. But then also, it has this, you know, stronger, I mean, I care when BB-8's in peril too, but like, it's a stronger sort of child. And then of course, when you think about how Baby Groot was made, which is Groot sacrificing himself for, you know, his family in the last movie. I mean, I don't mean to get too like, this is so deep and emotional, but I mean, James Gunn said something on
Twitter. Clearly they've thought about it.
Well, James Gunn said something on Twitter that kind of blew my mind, which is that this Groot has none of the old Groot's memories. This is a new Groot.
Oh.
And so that Groot is dead. Like, that Groot died, you know what I mean?
For
these people. Yeah. And so, you know, they have this you know, not just because this thing is cute and defenseless, but also this thing, it reminds them of this other thing that sacrificed itself for them. You know, it's really well thought out. And in
also, can I add, before we get off Baby Groot, I think it's great that he doesn't like hats because he can't tell if it's part of somebody's head. And I want that to come back in Avengers so bad.
Yeah, like, also, you know, the fact that it keeps, like, attacking those little dinosaurs or, like, has a weird grudge with Drax for some reason, but then also sleeps on his shoulder. Like, Baby Groot's little, like, vicious moments make it, save it from being completely saccharine, you know? So.
I mean, he cuts off somebody's toe off screen.
It's great.
So. Oh, it's so good. I don't know. Yeah. So, like, if you're out there writing a, you know, 2,000 word piece about why there's too much Baby Groot, you really need to rethink your life priorities. And I say that as someone who publishes articles like that all the time.
You're allowed to not like Baby Groot. I just hope that if you don't like Baby Groot, you have noticed, which I didn't notice the first time, that you have noticed the way in which it was used as the storytelling device, which is really very clever. They could have just used it as a cute thing, but they used it to tell this very integral part of the story that we're watching.
Right. It's a perfect example of a filmmaker who is completely sort of in control of what they're doing and is thoughtful, because that very much could be a very cheap thing and it could be a very silly, stupid thing, but you can tell when you watch the movie that James Gunn and the rest of the people that were in the, you know, creative team of this movie thought a lot about Baby Groot and how Baby Groot interacts with the world around him. And I think that's super important. And that's what makes movies like Guardians of the Galaxy that much better than your average superhero movie, because of the thought that goes into the 6-inch tall tree character.
The twig.
Right.
The other thing I want to say, is this film fixed one of my major problems. You know, I saw Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 for a second time. I liked it. And then I was like, okay, I should go home and watch the first Guardians of the Galaxy, which I own, to like try to, you know, like remember, like evaluate which one do I like better. And when I watched the original Guardians of the Galaxy, which I really did like, I was reminded of my huge, huge common Marvel movie problem, which is that this villain is garbage. Ronan was garbage villain, poorly paced, like couldn't do anything under all that fucking makeup and that headpiece. And like his motivation is just like stupid and boring. Whereas in this movie, yeah, you've got the Sovereign, which is another like paint smeared, you know, except you've got Elizabeth Debicki like doing great stuff. They're hanging out in an arcade. That's great. That's a great visual. But they're not really the villain. The villain, of course, is Kurt Russell. And since that villain is anchored in emotion and character, it matters. And it's fantastic. You know what I mean? This is my frequent complaint with Marvel. And I felt the same way about Civil War. Like, I really did feel like what they did, with Zemo.
Yeah.
What they did with him, like giving him this emotional sort of heft, made that matter to me in a way that, the random stuff in Doctor Strange doesn't. So.
Well, what I like about Guardians Volume 2 versus Guardians Volume 1 is Guardians Volume 2 knew enough to make the, you know, too many spaceships to actually have people in them, like part of the joke this time. Where it feels like Marvel has had, you know, like even the first Guardians, like not only was Ronan boring, but he had a whole species of Necro somethings that are just like completely forgettable and who gives a shit. We saw one of them once. This one, it's like the gold people are there, but they're well defined. And the joke is that they don't even get in their own spaceships anymore. So that's like how many there are. And then you have Ego, who is a singular person. And they decide to have a colorful version of the fight at the end of Man of Steel at the end, I definitely thought was exactly that.
But there's like no citizens of Gotham or citizens of Metropolis dying everywhere.
Well, neither was there in the first one, right? I guess we just had to retcon that in Batman v Superman. Maybe in Guardians 3 we'll learn that Ego had a sentient parasite we should have felt bad about killing. But I think we're okay. But yeah, like I really, the end of this movie, I don't know, I was trying to describe it to colleague David Ehrlich as knowing how to use color and texture that enhances both of those things and doesn't lean on one to, you know, pretend like it's cool. And it doesn't go quite as far that I'm able to completely suspend my disbelief that they're not fighting in a green screen room all the time, but it does get really close to having the balance of just the color popping on all the costumes, the, you know, non-humanness of things like Rocket or Mantis's, you know, antenna, and then Kurt Russell being a face on a planet with a beard. Like, all those things balance out to where they all look about as fake to me. So it's like a, I don't know. Never do they look real, but they all look equally as fake, and so therefore I bought into it on the emotional I'm Mary Poppins y'all level and just like latched onto that while things exploded around me. But I think that's why a lot of the overload is why the more distance I get from this movie, the more I end up liking its individual scenes. I think while you're in it, watching it for the first time, there's parts of Act Two that feel like characters are sitting down to give you monologues to tell you how they feel. But in retrospect, knowing the shape of the entire film, I don't ding the movie for that at all, for having a place where I didn't keep up with pacing.
Another big improvement I feel like on the first movie is it's not yet a great part of the movie, but it's an improvement, which is the attempt to give Gamora like a better storyline outside of being Star-Lord's love interest, right? So she's got this relationship with Nebula. I still think Nebula is kind of a garbage character, despite my affection for Karen Gillan. Like, I just don't think that character works, or that performance works. But, you know, Gamora does have a lot to do and a lot to feel. That has nothing to do with, you know, her man. So
it passes,
you know,
the Bechdel test.
I'm not sure it does, because aren't they always talking about their dad? So
that's right.
Yeah, I don't think it quite does, but you know, it's closer than it was before. But yeah, and
Well, I mean, it's sort of a retread of the plot they tried to give them for two scenes in the first Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
But at least this one, I mean, this is a good transition. Like, Nebula's, I think, story has to end in Infinity War, where I feel like the Guardians of the Galaxy, the majority of their stories are going to conclude in a Volume 3 that feels more like a third act to this story we're seeing. But there's a lot of this movie that has to position itself for the Guardians to show up somewhere else next. Specifically that it takes place so close after the first one, so you still have baby Groot, but then in the post-credits scene, we jump to teenage Groot, so that, you know, the Hulk and Groot could be the same size for whatever they're going to do next summer. And then
right,
I think also...
Infinity War is 4 years after... Infinity War takes place 4 years after Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So we are definitely getting... Right. Grown-ass Groot.
Yeah, and then the Zune, I think, was also something that's going to be easier to massage into Infinity War, because it'd be weird to give him a Volume 3 tape or whatnot through means of magical or story plot contrivance, and then have him go back to Earth and, you know, have Earth technology. And then I also think it's weird, this occurred to me while walking out of the movie, it's going to be weird to see these characters that I like on Earth without a score that is gonna, like, I'm not counting on the Infinity War soundtrack to be good. I think it's gonna be, you know, nonsense score. So I hope somebody planted the Zune in there for the Guardians of the Galaxy land on Earth and help with Thanos sequence, because if that doesn't have some cool music on it, I'm gonna kind of wish the Guardians of the Galaxy stayed in space.
Doesn't
which is,
Iron
I'm,
Man
feel like it.
Three. Like, I feel like a couple times Iron Man has flown around and, like, played fun rock songs.
Well, it's but it's all AC/DC.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So it's, like, kind of fun.
I need less AC/DC in my life. That's true. Okay.
We do need a moment, though, where Star-Lord and Tony Stark talk about, like, 70s rock music for,
and
like, a couple
and
minutes.
Have a posturing douche off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want the douche off.
What we've seen officially from, like, the Omaze Infinity War stuff is always Tom Holland, Robert Downey Jr., and Chris Pratt. So I could see those three characters snarking off with each other a lot, and apparently they will sometime in Infinity War.
Okay, but can we go back to talking about this movie that we have seen? And
I guess on Storm of Spoilers, we could talk about something we've already
I want to talk about, well, the Kraglin stuff is interesting to me, because that's one thing that sort of strikes me. I just don't love the Kraglin character, like, much love and respect to Sean Gunn. And I just really do feel like this is James Gunn wanting to give his brother, like, increasingly more. Like, I feel like Kraglin's going to basically be a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy in the next movie. And I...
Well, there's no way they're going to put him in Infinity War, because... And then I think that they'll keep him away from it, because Sean Gunn also plays Rocket, and I think he's going to be Rocket before he's Kraglin, and I read an interview that it got a little hairy for some of the Rocket-Kraglin in the same scenes.
Yeah,
scenes.
I read that too.
So I think we might be safe. I'm more worried that now Guardians 3000 wasn't just a throwaway joke, but now, like, the Ravagers are going to be Sylvester Stallone mush-mouthing through half of our movie next time. I think that's much more likely.
Well, I think, I know I just said, let's talk about the movie we just saw, but now I'm back on board talking about the future. I feel like what they're setting up is the Ravagers, because Sylvester Stallone, Michelle Yeoh, Ving Rhames, Michael Rosenbaum, Miley Cyrus, and one other person are basically, like, some of those characters, as Dave was the first to point out to me, were the original Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics. And so what we could have in the next film are, like, these two groups vying for the title of Guardians of the Galaxy, which could be kind of fun and funny. I feel like you don't tease future exploits of Michelle Yeoh, Ving Rhames, Sylvester Stallone, et cetera, if you're not going to deliver on it, with Adam Warlock as our villain. Right? Like, doesn't that seem... It's like, because Guardians always has, like, multiple villains, multiple antagonists, and a lot of those antagonists become friends. But that's what it seems like to me, you know?
I would just say that without Yondu, the Ravagers as a force seem extraneous. Like, I realize that we've invested some in them for two movies now, so it'd feel weird if they were gone. But I would maybe like an opening sequence where they're vying for who's going to be the real Guardians of the Galaxy. But yeah, I don't want them to stick around. Like, I don't want Miley Cyrus to actually be a Marvel superhero, you know?
Yeah.
I just want her to have a few voice cameos, and people are like, Miley Cyrus. But if it's like, let's spend the time figuring out how Mainframe was invented by aliens, I'm going to be like, fuck you, Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Well, and I wouldn't mind Michelle Yeoh and Ving Rhames, though. I have to say.
Oh, no. Like, I want to see them do cool things, but I don't think the Ravagers as a group needs to be the other force besides Nova and Guardians of the Galaxy. And, like, I like the way this universe feels like a whole bunch of people who are out for themselves, and then, like, the Nova is okay police force, but, like, can't really do anything.
Do you like
I like that feeling.
Glenn Close, couldn't he be fucked to, like, film a cameo as, like, Nova gets subsumed by Tar, you know?
Well,
she couldn't even be like in front of a green screen and be like, god damn it, not again.
Yeah, something.
Is she gonna cameo in Infinity War, do you think?
I don't know.
Because she's got the purple stone.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about Infinity Stones.
What?
Here's what's funny, Dave. Okay. We can talk about Infinity Stones. Here's what's funny.
This is like Dave's favorite thing.
I know. I'm sorry. I take it back. Here's the question. If Adam Warlock in the comics, in at least part, some of his comic storyline, is powered by the Soul Gem.
Yeah.
But Adam Warlock is not going to show up in Infinity War.
Correct.
How does the Soul Gem get to Thanos?
Wait, isn't the Soul Gem already somewhere?
No. That's the remaining stone, right, Dave?
Yes, but I think we have a theory about where it is.
Do
you think it's on Heimdall?
Oh, it's his eyes balls.
Oh, no, it's the gem that you can see has been added to his armor in Thor the Dark World.
So you think this version of Adam Warlock will have nothing to do with the Soul Gem?
Correct. They've already said Adam Warlock is not in Infinity War.
I knew that. Okay. All right.
Oh, but, I mean, I guess the possibility that you would say is they would, or I guess the way they would do it is Infinity War happens and somehow the Soul Gen is what gets him to come out of his little cocoon. But I would say that that's way too similar to how Vision was created for them to allow that to happen.
Well, what's interesting is for Guardians to end with the leader of the Sovereign, Aisha, saying, I will call him Adam. And then knowing that between Guardians 2 and Guardians 3, there's a 4 year later Infinity War. And so like, is Adam just like training in that time or like what? Or would it be kind of fun to have like Adam Warlock fight the Guardians off screen and the Guardians like show up with the Soul Gem or something like that? Do you know what I mean? Like, they don't have to show up with Adam, but they've got the Soul Gem. I don't know. It's all confusing. I
mean, that's an interesting conversation that I feel like could be its own speculation podcast of the future, which is, do you need the Infinity Gems in this universe after Infinity War? Because you could. You've introduced the most powerful MacGuffins in your fictional universe for your, you know, your first 10-year arc. Oh, God. Oh God, it's gonna be that long. Yeah. Okay.
10 years. Can I ask you guys a question about Mantis?
Yeah,
sure.
Did Mantis give you any sort of creepy,
Uncanny Valley?
No, geisha vibes.
No.
No,
I don't know that much about geisha culture to really stereotype it, but
I just didn't like that the Asian character is like this sort of babyish, subservient, getting nagged by Drax character.
Well,
it just struck me as weird.
I'm a fan of the theory that there was more to the script at some point, that Ego's motivations were changed. Because at some point he's like, you know, help me spread this thing so that we could both be gods. But then like later he's like, oh, I'm just going to use you as a battery, that maybe he needed to recharge the whole time, and that's why Mantis needs to, like, make him sleep. Because the whole sleeping thing's never explained, and so therefore Mantis is never really explained. We just sort of, like, take it as God needs help to sleep because he thinks too much. But I feel like at some point there was something that made her a little less subservient, a little more necessary, but that's not in the movie.
She's still subservient, even if she's necessary. And my interpretation of the whole ego battery thing was that, like, Ego is like, if you want to do it with me, great, then we can both be gods. But if not, I'm just going to use you as a battery. Either way, I do need you. I can't do it alone. So I need your extra juice. It would be fun if we were father, son, buddy, buddy while we did it. But if you're going to be a little asshole and get mad at me for killing your mom, then I'm just going to plug into you, you know? And so, right. Yeah, the idea that he does need to sort of hibernate in order to recharge makes sense to me. But I don't know how knowing that makes Mantis, I mean, I like Mantis, you know, but like, I don't know that it makes it a less, I guess I will say, problematic character for me. So,
well, I guess the only reason it's problematic for me is that Mantis is a bullshit character as she exists. It's like six different writers tried to make her a daughter of this and it's, you know, a descendant of that. And so the simplified version that worked with Drax in the moment, I sort of forgave, but I don't think you're wrong. I just, it didn't play that way to me.
That being said, Drax is my second favorite character in this movie. And every time that Dave Bautista laughed, I laughed. Every time Drax just bellows laughter, I was like, I also am enjoying myself. So.
All right. Any last thoughts on Infinity War? Oh, God. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2?
It's great. I can't wait to go see it again. I almost went to see it again today. I can't stop listening to the soundtrack. As an adult, as a post 30-year-old man, I don't get excited about, like, I don't become sort of like engulfed by movies anymore, and it's really refreshing when that happens, and that absolutely happened with this one. So go see it and just let it take over your life for a couple hours.
I like that advice. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Neil, take us into what we're going to be doing next week.
Oh, what are we doing next week? Oh, hold on. I got the notes. Next week is the final, technically non-Game of Thrones off-season tour episode. So we're going out. Yeah, and then the week after, we're doing Game of Thrones Season 1. Next week, we're going out with a bang. We are talking about one of the longest running, most iconic franchises in all of cinema. One that spans the dawn of summer blockbusters and the, it's still going. sorry, I had a
the franchise nothing. That launched a bunch of white guys' careers.
Right, but also the franchise that took a lady person and was like, she's going to be the badass.
Yes.
Which was revolutionary at the time. It's still sort of revolutionary now. It's Alien. The Alien Anthology, as it's so lovingly called. So we're going to talk our way through from Ridley Scott's original Alien through the other not so great. Although, you know what? Jean-Pierre Jeunet is a master and everyone can just take a walk on this one.
Are we going to go through it our world chronologically or their world chronologically?
We don't know yet. We're going to spend a lot of time thinking about that. but it will all lead, it will ultimately lead to a discussion about Covenant. Whether that happens at the beginning or the end is TBD. But we're going to talk Alien, Covenant, Prometheus, the original Alien quadrilogy, and other expanded. Is there more expanded universe to that?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm Alien a fan of AVP Requiem just because
those movies.
They drop a nuke on Colorado at the end of it.
I forgot about those
and
movies.
That's how that movie ended.
Does Predator count as a full-on extension at this point because of Alien vs. Predator?
Here's my like one of my favorite Easter eggs. There's an Alien game where one of the hidden characters is named Major Dutch, and he's a cyborg. So Arnold Schwarzenegger is so good at killing this alien they've never found before in Predator that they bring Dutch back and use him as the basis for an alien-fighting cyborg that eventually is taken over by Skynet and becomes the Terminator. Now it's the biggest franchise ever.
That's fantastic. So we'll also be talking about Predator, apparently. But anyway, we're going to talk about the Alien Anthology and all of its many tentacles. So that should be a lot of fun.
As you could tell, I am psyched already.
Joanna, how do you feel about it?
I feel good. I am unusually prepared for this because I watched, for some reason, all the Alien movies last fall and many of them for the first time. So, I hadn't seen 2, 3, or Requiem. What is it called?
Resurrection.
Resurrection. So I watched all of those and I rewatched Prometheus. I didn't rewatch. Maybe I should rewatch Alien because I haven't seen that in a long time. Mm. But
I think I'm gonna probably try and rewatch all.
And then I watched all of the documentaries that are all on YouTube.
Yes,
and they're all fascinating. So you can watch all of the like behind the scenes stuff. It's really, really interesting.
We've
like,
set a very high bar for homework this week.
David Fincher had the worst time of his life making that movie, and. And yeah,
I
think
it's been
chronicled
for our entertainment.
Anyway.
It's interesting side note. If you do want to do those behind the scenes documentaries that Joanna's talking about, the Alien 3 one is really good. It was originally cut down by Fox. So the one that's on YouTube is the abbreviated one, which motivated me to go to iTunes and buy it digitally. And they have the restored one, which has an additional like 8 minutes that the studio initially wanted cut out about how they screwed David Fincher. But then after everybody loved the quadrilogy release, they restored the documentary to its full title. It's called Wreckage and Rage.
Oh, nice.
Now, if you check that out.
Ooh.
But the one for Aliens, number 2, is also really interesting. Galen Heard. Gives a lot of interesting like background information. And then the one for Alien is really interesting because you've got these like these guys who like, you know, I think people just basically credit Alien entirely to Ridley Scott, which is wildly inaccurate because these two like really dorky sci-fi writers wrote it. So, you know, you get to watch them get interviewed and stuff like that. I didn't watch a documentary for the fourth one. I think
it's really good because It's like a whole bunch of French people being like, is then we thought we'd make it swim. Why not?
I love Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
So there you go.
Do not know why they wanted me for the alien, but
there you go.
What's so good. Yeah.
Why are the androids filled with yogurt? We don't know. It's fine.
In the next one, he will fight Amelie.
I thought maybe half you, like, alien is the mother, and then the baby just claw her face off.
And you guys thought this would be a week without accents.
Oh, if you right want to hear end. Accents, you can tune into our American Gods episode 2 recording, where Gail and I have a history of doing terrible Russian accents. So Cloris Leachman and Peter Stormare just like gave us all the excuse we needed to let loose. So there you go. Terrible Russian accents, American Gods edition.
Speaking of your American Gods podcast, where can people find other work by you on this wide internet?
You can either find me on vanityfair.com or on Twitter at @StopYourGrinningAndDropYourLinen.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
You can find me on Twitter at @Rejects. You can also find me, by the time you listen to this, hopefully on Film School Rejects, which will once again exist after 10 days of thankless work on my part. So filmschoolrejects.com. Also, don't forget to follow our show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have questions, thoughts, comments, if you have any spreadsheets of how many times we've said or anything that you want to send us, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Also, if you have any thoughts, questions about the Alien franchise, which is our next show, so send those over.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where my pinned article is where I compare the end of Guardians of the Galaxy and the choice Peter Quill makes to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane in the Gospels.
Nice.
Find out how at Thrillist.com. You can find the rest of my podcast work at FightingInTheWarRoom.com. And until next week, don't look inside any alien eggs that open when you approach them, and don't touch any snakes in black goo, and we should see you.
Just don't touch anything.
Just never touch anything.
Be a damn scientist for once. You're from the heart.